Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 3rd of February, 2026. It is a Tuesday evening and the time is 1 minute past the hour of 9. So ladies and gentlemen, we are most now doing, we are doing things, right? We are most talking about the issues that we want to talk about and we are putting it all out there. We are airing our dirty lines. We're airing our dirty laundry and it is what it is. So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about head of the household. Now that concept in itself is most, I am the head of the house. And rightfully so. There's most a head, there's a neck. I don't know. Are the kids the stomach? Are the kids the arms, the fingers? I don't know. But apparently there's this whole saying of, I'm the head of the house. Now, this head of the house, I was like, oh, yeah, but what does it mean? In contemporary Africa, in contemporary Namibia, in contemporary world, what does it mean to be the head of the house? Then I went to Ude. I went to the people that speak the things that spraken the things that I want them to be talking about. And they said, for men, being head of the house traditionally means taking ultimate responsibility for the family's well-being. Hey. Now that is the first one, for the family's well-being. Now, what is the family's well-being? Because if we have to dissect everything, if we have to put everything out there onto the table, there are certain things that we have to look at. And these things are the ones that actually make every conversation worth having. It makes everything like, it's like an aha moment for everything. Like, let's clap hands, like snap fingers, like, yeah, okay, I get it. So this is what the head of the household is supposed to do. So the responsibility, taking up the ultimate responsibility for the family's well-being. Now, when we look at well-being, what is well-being? Well-being is most, if we're putting it in layman's terms, we're talking about the family must be nga, the family must be unandi, the family must be healthy, the family must be good, the family must be comfortable, the family must be okay, right? But I think that in modern day society, we take this particular saying and we nitpick on the little things that we want. So it's like the culture debate where we teach our children the things about our culture that we want them to know and the other things that we don't deem important, right? We push it to the side. So now our children, Pashindonga, they say that you must not greet elders while you're standing. Pashindonga. And you must also not eat with your hand, your other hand on the ground. Pashindonga ne. And also you must eat with your right hand, not your left hand. Pashindonga ne. Because I can't talk about other people because, you know, I'm most not other people. So I'm talking about the ones that I do know. Pashindonga, you understand? And these are little sayings that, these are just small sayings, small things. And it might not even be as big as you entering into somebody's household through okampangwa. You understand? Okampangwa is like, no. Okampangwa is only for people of the household, not for you strangers. So you can't just walk up to somebody's house and then you pass by okampangwa. Like, it doesn't work like that. It doesn't go down like that. It is not like that. Okay? It doesn't. Okay. So these are little things that we know. And with these little things that we know, we know that, okay, so as a Vambu girl, you must also ikonyeka, you know, as a Vambu girl, you must also not eat with your hand on the ground. And as a Vambu girl, like with some of us, we were taught that you must eat your pap finish before you eat the meat. And so these are practices, ne, that were practiced within our our lives. And up until today, some of these things, some of these things, we dive with them and we run with them for a while. And then apart from that, sometimes we leave them behind and sometimes we choose what exactly it is that we are going to be, you know, we're going to be taking. And it's the same way as I'm saying that Pashindonga, a child is not supposed to be greeting you, like, as long as this person is older than you, you're not supposed to be greeting them while you are standing. You're supposed to go on one knee and you're supposed to greet elders. That's how you greet elders. Pashindonga ne. I don't know about you other people, mara Pashindonga ne oshonengao. But then, right? The same people that are saying, yeah, as a cultural man, as a cultural man, as an African man, as a cultural somebody, right? In my culture, are the same people that are allowing their children to greet people while they are standing in their households. So I feel like we nitpick which areas we want and we leave the ones that we don't want. Just like you, your children don't speak Oshindonga at all. They don't speak Oshindonga. They don't even know one word in Oshindonga. They speak English and you want to blame the kindergarten, but the child is not at kindergarten 24/7. What about weekends? What about after work when you are actually around? You guys are speaking English with Junior. And now Junior doesn't know how to speak Oshiwambo because it is what it is. And you're like, yeah, that's old news. That's old fashioned. That's old whatever. But then you still want to live by the proverbs of, I am the head of the house. I am the head of the house. So the head of the house, we are going now to this ultimate responsibility of well-being. How seriously do we take the well-being of the family? How seriously do we consider the well-being of the family? And is it just something that we throw out there? Or do we just throw it out there? And do many of us even know that that is what it is? The meaning of being the head of the house is to take care of the family's well-being. Do we know that? And this family's well-being, right, is inclusive. Many of us say that, oh, a man is supposed to be, and a man is supposed to be, and a man is supposed to be, and a man is supposed to be. But it isn't actually that. That is inclusive of well-being of the family. So well-being is the umbrella, and everything else that you are thinking a man should be is what trickles down this umbrella. So the well-being of the family is inclusive of providing food, for example, providing shelter or providing financial support or, and the works, right? These are inclusive. It is not all that a man is supposed to be or the head of the house is supposed to be. It's not all. This is inclusive. Inclusive means that it is part of family's well-being. So now many of us are thinking that as long as there's money and as long as there's shelter and as long as there's food, then I am a man and I have provided for my family. But what about everything else that falls underneath well-being? What is it? What is it exactly that falls underneath well-being? What is well-being? What is family well-being? Let's dive into it because I'm tired. I'm tired of, I'm tired of men claiming this title, men taking up this title. Like, I am the head of the house. You know, I wear the pants around here. I'm tired of this because I've noticed that many of them, many of you guys don't do much. You guys just run around. Many of you guys, there are a select few that are actually heads of the house, but there are so many imposters. There are so many fake ones, right? And all they are demanding is respect for a title that they don't even understand. They are demanding for a title that they can't actually, they can't look at it. So let's go into what family well-being is, because they said, Moss, right, the head of the house. For a man, or for men, being head of the house traditionally means taking ultimate responsibility for the family's well-being, including providing food, shelter, and financial support. Modern interpretation emphasizes emphasizes on leadership for a family unit. Okay? So that is what it is there. So now we're looking at family well-being. All right. So with family well-being, family well-being is a multi-scenario state where all members are safe, healthy, and economically stable, enabling them to thrive together. So that is what family well-being is. That is what it is. When somebody says like, yeah, it's for my family's well-being, right? It is, a multidimensional state where all members are safe. For example, safe, right? So we're going down this list because I want for those that don't understand to understand today. Today's your day to understand. We're going with safe, and then we are going with health, right? And then we are going with economics. And then we are going with economic stability, actually. And then we are going with enabling them to thrive. Thriving is doing extremely well, doing well. And that is how you determine the well-being of the family, right? Family well-being is a multidimensional state where all members are safe, healthy, and economically stable, enabling them to thrive together. It encompasses physical, mental health, strong relationships, and resilience to challenges. Key components include access to quality, consistent support services, supportive parenting, and nurturing and secure environments. So that is what family well-being entails. That is what it is, Chomi. That is what we are supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be having this. This is what the family well-being is consistent of. So now we go back to our initial statement for what the head of the house traditionally means. And it's taking care of ultimate responsibility for the family's well-being. Then everything else is inclusive. So everything else is inclusive is now the providing, the shelter, the finances. So the finances lay under economic stability, right? And then shelter goes under safety. But it is half a mark. It is not a full mark. It is half a mark because you can have shelter, but you're still not safe, right? You can have a place to stay, but it's uncomfortable. You can have a place where you are at, but it is not where you want to be. You can have a roof over your head, but this roof is raining. You can have a roof over your head, but this roof is non-existent. You can have walls around you, but there's no concrete. And there is so many things when it comes to safety that we can say shelter does fall under safety because at least you know that you can always have somewhere to go. And that is what we're going, or that is the agenda that we're driving when it comes to shelter, because you always have a home, right? You always have a home. There's always a place for you to thrive. There's always a place for you here. Either it's your grandmother's or your mother's or your father's or your parents, wherever it is that you have shelter, as long as you have shelter. That is what we talk about when we also talk about safety. But this one is not a full mark. It is a half mark because unfortunately, under shelter, we can't say that that shelter falls entirely under safety because it is multidimensional. And also, it could be that even if you have a place to stay, even if you have a home, it might not actually be safe. It might actually be safer on the streets. Have you ever looked at these street children and wondered, why are you so young and you are here? Why are you on the street? You know, except for Cat Mashaba. Or is it Cat Mashala? Yeah, Cat Mashala. Except for Cat, you know, like, he's one of the, and UB40. He's one of those few kids that actually made it, and now, like, I don't know, man. With Cat, I don't know. He's just a ruthless criminal. Okay, cool. Mara. We can't necessarily always say that shelter in itself is safety. It might be safety from the rain, but you are exposed to a pedophile. It might be safety for the night, but you are exposed to a Hulk situation. It might be safe in a sense that you do have a blanket, you have a bed, but people are beating each other left, right, and center. It might be safe in a sense that you always have a place that you can call home, but your home is also a shebeen, and it has a bar, and it also has characters, weird characters, pedophiles, kleptos, alcoholics, gamblers, all of that is in your house because your house is a bar. And that is why we cannot necessarily say that shelter in itself falls entirely under safety, because it's not everybody that is safe in their own homes. It's not everybody that is living a scot-free life where everything is just amazing and it's just roses, and they're living with in a conducive environment, and they are living by the book, and they are living by the word. And we can't say that, because many a times when we go through newspapers and court cases and etc., we find that sometimes the abuse happens right here. Sometimes the abuse happens in the household. Sometimes it's not a stranger. Sometimes it's not a weird man that's coming from Kunta Kinte, Kilimanjaro, wherever, to come and abuse you. Sometimes the abuser lives with you. Sometimes it's an uncle. Sometimes it's an aunt. Sometimes it's a sibling. Sometimes it is a neighbor that is allowed access into this home, this shelter that you are supposed to be calling safe, and now you are no longer safe. Sometimes it might be issues of domestic violence. Sometimes it might be anything at all. And the weirdest part, or the oddest part about human nature, is the fact that many of us are so used to keeping the little secrets that we have within ourselves. We are so accustomed to keeping the secrets. We are so accustomed to being quiet about things that we shouldn't be quiet about. Nobody actually knows what we as a people are going through. And lucky for you, I'm here to talk about all your problems. So that is why we can't put shelter under safety completely, because you might have a shelter. Right? The man of the house might have provided shelter, might have provided food, might have provided financial support, but he might have also given a multitude of disorders. He might have been the person that pushed you over the edge. He might have been the person that traumatized you. He might have been the person that done hammered you finish. He might have been the perpetrator, or he might have been the person that turned a blind eye towards your abuse. Now, many of us don't talk about the abuse, and especially when it comes to family members that are extremely good at manipulation and extremely good at gaslighting, or avoidant family members, then you would find that many pretend it never happened. And you don't understand, especially if something happened to you when you were younger, you don't understand why you are the way you are. And nobody has told you anything about you that you might have blocked out. Like, I believe that there are certain things when we see certain characters within children that we must buckle up and go and talk about. For example, a child that is conceived from rape, right? In as much as we like to pretend as human beings that things don't affect us, and inimaka inasha iningi, and this next thing, you have to understand that what happened to you was traumatic. It traumatized you in one way or another. even if you are saying that you are absolutely fine. Maybe you saying that you're absolutely fine is a coping mechanism of you are not fine. We don't know. We're not brain doctors. We're not neurosurgeons. Yeah. And also, then you go on to carry this child to full term. This unplanned, unloved, unwanted child. Many of us want to put these elements away in a suitcase. Because, I mean, this is my child. This is my child alone. I will raise this child. My child, right? But where the child comes from and the origins of the child also matters. So now, your child, because you've gone through pregnancy with all these emotions, like mother, you've gone through all these emotions that you had to bottle up, you had to keep in. And sometimes you felt some type of way and you consoled yourself with, it's my child. But you deep down, you know that you can't make a child alone, but okay. So you take it up and you go through and bam, when you give birth to the child, you just fall into a great depression. But this depression that you have is not the kind of depression where you're turning away from the baby and you just don't want anything to do with the baby. It is the irritating sounds that happens in your head. It's the irritating sounds that happen in your ears. It's that annoying thing that might actually give you a stroke, because in as much as you are you, acknowledging and understanding that there are days where you're not going to like this child doesn't mean you love them less. Just means that you don't like where they came from and how they came about. Then your child grows up. Let's say your child is a male, or it doesn't even matter in this case because it happens to both genders. I was having a conversation with a driver today, and he was talking about, how the boy child, doesn't necessarily go through things such as rape. And I told him, you are very wrong. Indeed, you are. You're very wrong, because it happens more to the boy child than you think. It's only that the boy child is apparently built to be resilient, apparently. But they break a lot under pressure. You can see police officers are shooting their girlfriends. Yeah? Imagine if it's a wife. Okay? Just a girlfriend. And turning the guns on themselves. I'm just saying. I'm not implying anything. I'm just saying. We all advocate for the men to talk, but in all honesty, I don't know if you actually want to hear it, because it just sounds the same constantly. So it's like, okay. So it happens to men and women. So your son grows up, and because you have been sharing hormones with your child during pregnancy, your child comes out a little messed up. And a little messed up, I'm not talking about physically. I'm talking about as they grow, they are highly sensitive, highly emotional, highly what. They are very in tune, if we must put it that way. So your child has this aggressive nature of not taking no for an answer. Your child is very persuasive. Your child is very cunning and manipulative, right? Good evening.
Oh, the matriarch.
Yes.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm cool, man.
You're cool?
Yeah, I'm cool. Yeah.
All right. Are you the head of the house?
It is within our nature, man.
What is within your nature?
The men have to be the ruler.
Okay. What are you ruling over? What are you ruling over?
A woman has to be submissive.
submissive to what?
Yeah, to what they ask them.
Okay. All right, so women must be submissive.
Yeah, and yeah.
Is it because you are a great leader, or is it because you are a man?
Now we perceive to be a great leader.
You perceive. The key word is perceive, right?
Yeah, it's a perception, yeah.
Okay, you perceive yourself to be a great leader. No one actually guarantees this.
Yeah, but it is within our masculine energy.
Yeah, no. Energy is energy, okay. But,
yeah.
Because there's no crazy person that thinks that they are crazy.
Mm.
Mm. Everybody thinks that they're sane. Everyone. Even the one that is locked up will not say that, guys, I'm crazy, so, yeah, I'm just doing this because I'm crazy. Like, nobody says that. Everybody thinks that they are perfectly in their good state of mind. So, you perceive and assume yourself to be a great leader because of your genitalia.
Yeah.
Okay, strictly on that. Not because you are actually wonderful. Not because the world around you has miraculously become better, but just because of your penis only.
Are you? Don't go there, man.
I'm asking.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you perceive yourself to be a great leader, right? And you perceive yourself worthy enough to lead a woman and her children.
Yeah.
That is your family unit.
Yeah.
Okay. Because of this self-proclaimed leadership skills that you have, that nobody actually told you about, and most probably nobody harnessed.
Yeah, either. It's supposed to be like this.
Okay, because you are born with it because of your penis.
Yeah.
Oh, it's natural.
It's natural.
Okay. So leadership comes automatic. With men.
We become leader by default.
Okay, you guys become leaders by default because of your genitalia strictly.
Yeah.
Not because you're smarter than me, not because you're faster than me, not because you're stronger than me.
But
not because
you're supposed to be smart, man.
But are you? Are you?
Yeah.
Are you smarter?
I'm smarter.
Oh, okay. All right. You are smarter. Okay. And this is smarter. Another self-proclaimed thing, right? Because you haven't actually gone and got your IQ tested so that somebody can actually verify if you're smart or not, right? So these are all assumptions, that you're a great leader, that you are smarter. All right. So what if me, as the woman that is next to you, I see your leadership as weak? What happens?
Leadership is supposed to be a joint effort.
Is it a joint effort if you are the leader?
Yeah, but it will be a shared responsibility.
Isn't it just you taking my ideas as your wife and playing them off as your own because I'm smarter than you?
It can be, but because we are not limited when it comes to knowledge acquisition.
Okay. But you said you're smarter and you are a leader by nature. Yeah.
By nature,
you're supposed to be a leader and you're supposed to be smarter. You're supposed to be everything better than a woman.
Yeah, a woman is supposed to be obedient.
Obedient. So now, okay, so if you are telling me, right? Do you remember when, I think it was last year, at the beginning of the year?
Yeah.
There was this guy with a double cap bucky. And then he decided to drive through the water.
Yeah.
And then the water swept him away. How many women have you seen swept away by the water?
I never seen one.
Oh, okay. So, all right. Fine. Let's move from that one. Okay. Because he's a man and he's a leader and he makes smart decisions. You know that guy. No. Because it's genetics. We are working with genetics here. We are working with genetics, because men are natural born leaders and they're naturally smarter. Okay. So let me ask you, How many times have you seen a woman with a 5-liter Gandini going to put in petrol in a 5-liter Gandini because her car was stuck on the highway?
I.
How many?
None of them.
Okay, how many guys have you seen doing it?
Okay.
So, but men are still smarter.
Yeah, you guys, you castrated us.
No, we didn't castrate anybody, my dear. That was all your parents. If you're circumcised, because, that's all up to you. No. I'm just asking on the basis of our conversation, you know? Because I want to know from a man's perspective. Because you guys are natural, you are natural born leaders. You perceive yourself as natural born leaders. Yes. And you are naturally smarter. But yet, you are the same people that can't.
We are considered by the constitution now.
Okay, but you guys can't estimate petrol.
Yeah.
But you guys get you guys get swept away by water.
But you guys know most of the laws are being taken by the woman.
It's not roles, because there a woman was not there. That guy was driving his bucket by himself.
Yeah.
That man. That smart leader man. He was driving his car by himself. There was no woman that said just go in the water there. It was just all him.
The problem with men when it comes to make those decisions, those decisions are very, I don't know how to put it.
What decisions?
They are very disgusting, man, to say.
Which decisions?
Yeah, the decision, especially the one that they want, if they want to end their life.
No, we're not talking about ending their lives. We're talking about you have a Toyota double cab, or it is a Suzu double cab, and you are driving through moving water when you can see other cars turning back, other cars that are even bigger than yours and have a bigger engine than yours. And then you decide that you are going to drive through the water.
Navigate the water.
Because me, my car is stronger. But that's a smart person. Right? Okay, so now, if that guy is someone's husband. If that guy is someone's husband.
What can you do?
No. In that scenario, that's why you have never seen women nundini. Because we put in enough petrol. And we estimate petrol. And we also have more money.
Men like to gamble with you.
Now the question is, okay, so you have put up a valid point, gamble. With life. All right. So how am I supposed to trust you? Right? As the woman that is next to you while I'm watching you gamble. With your life. I must just be submissive. And I must just let my children drown because you are a gambler.
No.
So I must just allow you to kill us. You can't lead yourself, but I must allow you to lead us.
Because of your genitalia.
No. Just strictly because of your genitalia, and because not even anybody, nobody even told you that you are smarter. You didn't even go for an IQ test, right? You have never even participated in a quiz a day in your life, but apparently you are smarter than me, and I must just put my whole existence into your hands because of your genitalia.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like that.
Oh, it's supposed to be like that. So even when you are driving us to the north and you are driving a car that's half empty and then we just get stuck there on the Western Bypass, I must just allow you as a man, I must just ewatate.
Yeah, but those are the reckless men.
Yeah, but nobody is written reckless and responsible on their forehead. But all of you guys have the same genitalia. Yeah, but all of you have the same genitalia, and that's genetically proven. You know, all of you guys have the same genitalia. So that's genetically proven. But then you are also saying you perceive men to be leaders. You perceive men to be smarter. You perceive men to be gamblers of life. So now, why exactly how are you going to be the support system of the family when you don't even know how to support yourself?
Yeah, maybe they like oversharing.
My dear, you don't know how to support yourself, say. Let's talk about support. What is it? What is support?
Oh, to pull the family together.
Pull the family together in what sense? Just hold on. Mm-hmm. In what sense?
To put them in the right direction.
Put them in the right direction. Like, determine their future.
To extend their helping hand.
Wait. No. Don't jump off of it. Because I'm asking questions about things that you are saying. Right? Mm. So to determine their future, or what exactly is that?
Everyone in the family, to make sure that everyone.
Okay, pull everyone together. How are you pulling them together?
By supporting them financially.
Okay, financial.
Moral.
Okay, morals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Emotional.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so on.
And so on is what? Et cetera is what?
Et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera is what? Tell me what lays under et cetera.
And many more.
And many more are who? Who are the many mores? Who are the many mores? So, talking about financial support, right? What is financial support?
For example, just to pay the children's school fees.
Okay, pay school. But school is free.
Yeah, it was back in the day when it
No, we're not talking about back in the day. We're talking about contemporary times. So school is free. So what are you paying
but
for?
It's not the entire free.
So you're supposed to be buying the things that the government does not provide.
It's not going to be enough, yeah.
Okay. All right. So pay the children's school. What else?
For accommodation.
Okay.
Transport.
Mm-hmm.
Pocket money.
Mm-hmm.
And other basic necessities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you don't have this, you're not a man.
You are a man.
Oh, okay. So you must be a beggar.
It's not a beggar per se.
Per se, but technically.
Yeah, technically.
Okay, so technically speaking, if you don't have financial capacity. Okay, so hustling looks like what in contemporary times?
Start a business.
With what? With what? If I can't buy bread.
All the business I started with the idea.
My dear, I don't have money for bread for school. I don't have money for pencils, coloring pencils.
So that's why the men.
As a man now. As a man, I don't have money for coloring pencils. So I must go and beg. Okay. So men are beggars. That is what it means to be a man. Beg. Men beg.
Need to be stronger.
Okay. They go and beg. Okay. So when you say morals. When you say morals. What's that?
To instill discipline.
Okay, so it's beating children or what?
Yeah?
Is it beating children? Because I'm asking you, what is morals?
Moral is to do the right thing.
Okay, to do the right thing. What is doing the right thing?
To behave in ethical manner.
Okay, so you must pretend to be something that you're not.
Because
most of you guys are not really led by your moral compass. No. You guys are not really led by your moral compass. You guys are killing women. No. This is not a competition. I'm just saying that you are supposed to be teaching morals. But what morals do you have that significantly can impact my life as a man now? You, the leader of this family.
It makes all of the people live up to moral standard.
Okay, but what is the moral standard now? What is the standard?
Behaving very well.
Okay, cultured. Which culture are we talking about? Let's go with culture.
We uphold our principles.
Okay, what are the principles of your culture?
Let's say integrity.
Okay, what about integrity?
Doing the right thing even if no one is watching you.
Okay, doing the right thing even if no one is watching you. But does your culture condone begging?
We see asking. There's nothing wrong with it.
No, not asking.
Stealing.
Begging. Begging. Yeah. Does your culture condone begging?
Yeah, yeah. Begging? Still there. Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's say, but women, they used to, they have seen it on women, whenever there's a hunger in their house, they used to go to the neighbor.
But we're not talking about women. Yeah, but we're not talking about women. We're most talking about the leader. We'll talk about the submissive one later. We're talking about the leader. You said the leader must go and beg. Eh? So in your culture, Akwanyama men go and beg.
Akwanyama
men go and beg. They beg. They are beggars. That's not hunting. That's begging. So for how long can a Kwanyama man beg? So every day you're just begging for food. Every single day. Then what happens on the days that father doesn't have energy to beg?
They used to be given a hook must to go catch.
Who gives hooks?
Yeah?
Who gives hooks?
They are fellow men.
Who are these fellow men that give hooks? Because me, I don't know of any fellow men that gives hooks. Nope. Not even. No.
It can be. It's doable.
It's doable, but is it happening?
Yeah, it's doable. Yeah, it's happening. Yeah.
Okay. So, you said that a family or a man must support his family.
Even men, some of the men, they used to be given kettles.
Oh, they used to be given kettle. But then that's a difference. He didn't go and beg for the kettle he was given. It was a gift. So that's completely different. But they were given, not beg. They didn't go and beg. Tatekulu, please. And even tomorrow, please. Tatekulu, please. I want you to hold the line for me so we conclude.
Yeah.
What will your friends think if you show up at school with a brand new 10th gen iPad?
TopScore Instant is making back to school in 2026 the coolest thing ever, giving away unbelievable prizes. To win one of 8 iPads or a weekly stationery voucher worth 1,000 Namibian dollars, simply buy a 1kg or 2kg TopScore Instant from any store nationwide and SMS Instant to 24442. Competition ends 31 March 2026. T's and C's apply. TopScore, a proud product of Namib Mills.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch and my guests, that says that men are natural born leaders and naturally born smart. Great. And they gamble with life. Wonderful. Okay. So, how am I supposed to be submissive to a guy that gambles with life?
Men supposed to be.
I'm asking now, because we have done the first half, right? We have established what a man is, right? And we have established that apparently he's supposed to teach morals. You guys are dying because you guys can't share emotional things, but then I must depend on you emotionally. No. I must depend on you that can't handle your own emotions. You guys are committing suicide because you guys are emotionally drained. And now me, as the submissive woman next to you, right? I must trust you enough with my emotions. When you can't even handle your own emotions. And I must trust you because of your genitalia. Am I not gonna end up committing suicide as well? Like you.
Naturally you don't take those
hands. No, but I'm being led by a man. And this is what men do. So, what type of advice is he going to give me if he can't even advise himself? Question.
I'm not saying anything, we don't express our emotions.
Yeah, but that's now the thing. Okay, but you said that a man is supposed to be something that is supportive. One, it must be financially supportive. It must have morals. It must have emotions. It must settle. It must also do things like pay for transport and etc. So now me, I'm asking, how are men supposed to be emotionally a woman's backbone when they can't carry their own emotions in their heads? And how are we supposed to trust their emotions when they don't trust their own emotions with themselves? Because it goes back, because my argument, because my argument in itself is that, okay, head of the household, right? Shouldn't that title be given to somebody that is actually capable of leading?
So you want women to be
No, I'm saying if you're going to be the head of the house, you should be able to lead. And the first thing about leadership is exactly the first thing that leading dictates is that you must live by the standards that you have set. So you don't want your children going out until 2 a.m., but yet you come home at 2 a.m. today. You don't want your children dating guys that are having multiple women, but yet you are cheating on their mother.
Yeah, there's a saying in English that it's easy to establish the principle of that.
But how can I be submissive to you when I can't trust you? How can I be submissive to you when you make such bad decisions for your own well-being? How can I trust you when you make such bad decisions for your own well-being? If it's for your own self, what about me that's just a stranger from my house? Of course. That's a great decision as a man.
Sharp, sharp.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. If you would like to call in and participate as well, the number in studio is 083-288-401. That is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio in case you would like to participate in our conversation. Today we're talking about the head of the household. Now, my argument is that the head of the household, the term in itself, is I believe that statement must go to a person that is capable of being the head of the household. We can't put the head of the household solely based on genitalia. Because, I mean, if we're only working for genitalia, then I don't know. Because they say that the head of the household, right? Responsibilities. Traditional responsibilities is ultimate responsibilities are for the family's well-being. So now, the family's well-being doesn't only mean shelter. It doesn't only mean food. It doesn't only mean finances. It also means emotional. It also means morals. It means discipline. It means structure. It means putting things in place. Now, if you are incapable of putting things in place in your own life, how are you going to put, how are you going to put things in place in my life? And how am I supposed to trust you with decisions that you are supposed to be making for the collective that you can't even make for yourself as an individual? Shouldn't the head of the household be somebody that actually knows the well-being of the household? Because I hear this so many times, you know, that men are the head of the household. But yet, the head of the household, head of the household, head of the household has not been home. Head of the household doesn't know how much bread costs because head of the household is not buying bread. Head of the household's money all finishes, especially, and I'm talking to you guys because today is the third and you have nothing. And you are apparently the head of the household, but you didn't pay any bills with your salary. You didn't pay anything with your salary. And your partner that is not the head of the household, that is only a partner, only a submissive wife, is basically doing everything that you are failing to do, but yet you want the title. I feel like men want the title. Men want the glorification that comes with being the head of the household. But they don't actually want the responsibility that comes with it. Or they don't even know what the responsibility that comes with it is. Okay, so we're talking finances. Or let's go to the basics. We're talking shelter as a provision of the family's well-being. Now, do you think that a child is safe in your care as a parent if you are like that, sir? If you are pundukaring at 4 o'clock from the bar, pundukaring at 2 a.m. from the club, bringing multiple partners, you don't even remember who the last person you had coitus with is. Are the children safe? You're bringing strangers into the house. You are bringing strangers into the household, right? And these strangers are people that come from wherever they are coming from. A little nyangi here, a little ka stay with me here, and ongura katunombiri, and you don't understand why, but it's because you brought Samantha into the house, but you are the head of the household. So at which point do we acknowledge as a people that the head of the household, title, cup, throne, crown, must go to the person that's actually leading the house and leading the family? Because if we are self-proclaimed smarter, right? Shouldn't smart people go for IQ tests to determine whether or not you actually are smarter? And the fact that you are out there saying that, yeah, but matriarch is not everybody that's book smart, but I'm smarter in other areas. That's how I know that you're not very smart. Because IQ test is not only for that smart, by the way, say, Mr. Honorable Menier. It's not only for that one. There are multiple IQ tests that determine what exactly you're good in. Problem solving, leadership, the IQ of what. Yes, that's how I know that you're not that smart. And maybe you shouldn't be the head of the house because you are driving through water when other cars are turning back. Because you think your Bucky is equivalent to a Land Cruiser. You are getting stuck on the highway and needing a 2-liter bottle to go and get 2 liters of petrol because you overestimated your kilometers. You underestimated the value of your petrol. And it's always only dudes. Like, I've never once seen a woman that's driving her car on empty. Ever. But with men, until the very last drop. Until they staka, they papa, they lala. And that's your way of life. So we're talking about head of the household. We're talking about family well-being. And this family well-being had me thinking, if men are incapable of being emotional creatures, how are they making sure that their family's well-being is actually kept? How? Because if you can't even be emotional, small emotions, you're not going to work for 10 years. Small emotions, you're giving up, you're going to the village. Small, you're medically boarded. Small emotions. You're medically boarded for life. It's cool. You never have to work. You just have to just be like that. Shouldn't the title go to the one that is actually doing everything? Let's go to responsibility and protection. The role of head of the household involves, right, securing the home. Securing the home is what? What does securing the home look like? Because many of you guys go out there to buy guns, apparently to secure the home, and end up using the guns on your wife, who is not supposed to be a threat on the home, and she's inside the home, but the gun is shooting her and not the outsiders that broke in last month. So securing the home. Do men actually still wake up to go and check if the doors are locked? If the doors are locked, if the gate is locked, or do they send the children to do it? The same children that forget to wash their underwear. They are the ones that are in charge of our security in this household. Okay, fine. Managing finances, right? How are you going to manage finances, sir, when you have a gambling problem? Ah, but I'm the man. Okay, but you have a problem. I know if I have a problem, then I shouldn't handle it. Then are you fully living up to the role? Because those are the elements, those are the sections underneath, right? Responsibility and protection. You're supposed to manage finances as a man. But many of you guys can't even buy curtains. Many of you guys have nothing, and today is the third. You guys got paid 3 days ago and you have nothing. Not because you paid bills, but because you are reckless with money. So how am I going to allow a reckless person with money, a person that's reckless with money, to handle my finances? How? How am I going to allow that? How am I going to allow you to have both our salaries in your hands? You that wants to buy Jordans. You that wants to drop the car. You that wants, I almost said a luminous, funny lights. How? How do I trust you with managing finances? if you can't even manage your own finances, if I had to come in and be your accountant.
John is the subject, Beat is the verb, Mary is the object. Good sentence. Now we're going to move to the second sentence, which says the same thing in the passive voice. Mary was beaten by John. And now a whole lot has happened in one sentence. We've gone from John beat Mary to Mary was beaten by John. We've shifted our focus in one sentence from John to Mary. And you can see John is very close to the end of the sentence, well, close to dropping off the map of our psychic plane. The third sentence, John is dropped, and we have Mary was beaten, and now it's all about Mary. We're not even thinking about John. It's totally focused on Mary. Over the past generation, the term we've used synonymous with beaten is battered, so we have Mary was battered. And the final sentence in this sequence, flowing from the others, is Mary is a battered woman. So now Mary's very identity, Mary is a battered woman, is what was done to her by John in the first instance. But we've demonstrated that John has long ago left the conversation. Now, those of us who work in domestic and sexual violence field know that victim blaming is pervasive in this realm, which is to say blaming the person to whom something was done rather than the person who did it. And we say things like, why do these women go out with these men? Why are they attracted to these men? Why do they keep going back? What was she wearing at that party? What a stupid thing to do. Why was she drinking with that group of guys in that hotel room? This is victim blaming. And there are numerous reasons for it, but one of them is that our whole cognitive structure is set up to blame victims. This is all unconscious. Our whole cognitive structure is set up to ask questions about women and women's choices and what they're doing, thinking, and wearing. And I'm not going to shout down people who ask questions about women. Okay, it's a legitimate thing to ask. But let's be clear, asking questions about Mary is not going to get us anywhere in terms of preventing violence. We have to ask a different set of questions. And you can see where I'm going with this, right? The questions are not about Mary, they're about John. The questions include things like, why does John beat Mary? Why is domestic violence still a big problem in the United States and all over the world? What's going on? Why do so many men abuse physically, emotionally, and other verbally in other ways the women and girls and the men and boys that they claim to love? What's going on with men? Why do so many adult men sexually abuse little girls and little boys? Why is that a common problem in our society and all over the world today? Why? Why do we hear over and over again about new scandals erupting in major institutions like the Catholic Church or the Penn State football program or the Boy Scouts of America, on and on and on, and then local communities all over the country and all the world, right? We hear about it all the time. Sexual abuse of children. What's going on with men? Why do so many men rape women in our society and all and around the world? Why do so many men rape other men? What is going on with men? And then what is the role of the various institutions in our society that are helping to produce abusive men at pandemic rates? Because this isn't about individual perpetrators. That's a naive way to understanding what is a much deeper and more systematic social problem. You know, the perpetrators aren't these, you know, monsters who crawl out of the swamp and come into town and do their nasty business and then retreat into the darkness. That's a very naive notion, right? Perpetrators are much more normal than that and everyday than that. So the question is, what are we doing here in our society and in the world? What are the roles of the various institutions in helping to produce abusive men? What's the role of religious belief systems, the sports culture, the pornography culture, the family structure, economics and how that intersects, and race and ethnicity and how that intersects? How does all this work? And then once we start making those kind of connections and asking those important and big questions, then we can talk about how can we be transformative. In other words, how can we do something differently? How can we change the practices? How can we change the socialization of boys and the definitions of manhood that lead to these current outcomes? These are the kind of questions that we need to be asking and the kind of work that we need to be doing. But if we're endlessly focused on what women are doing and thinking in relationships or elsewhere, we're not going to get to that piece. Now, I understand that a lot of women who have been trying to speak out about these issues today and yesterday and for years and years often get shouted down for their efforts. They get called nasty names like male basher and man hater and the disgusting and offensive feminazi, right? And you know what all this is about? It's called kill the messenger. It's because the women who are standing up and speaking up for themselves and for other women as well as for men and boys, It's a statement to them to sit down and shut up. Keep the current system in place because we don't like it when people rock the boat. We don't like it when people challenge our power. You better sit down and shut up, basically. And thank goodness that women haven't done that. Thank goodness that we live in a world where there's so much women's leadership that can counteract that. But one of the powerful roles that men can play in this work is that we can say some things that sometimes women can't say, or better yet, we can be heard saying some things that women often can't be heard saying. Now, I appreciate that's a problem, it's sexism, but it's the truth. And so one of the things that I say to men, and my colleagues and I always say this, is we need more men who have the courage and the strength to start standing up and saying some of this stuff. And standing with women, not against them, pretending that somehow this is a battle between the sexes and other kinds of nonsense. We live in the world together. And by the way, one of the things that really bothers me about some of the rhetoric that against feminists and others who have built the battered women's and domestic and rape crisis movements around the world is that somehow, like I said, that they're anti-male. What about all the boys who are profoundly affected in a negative way by what some adult man is doing against their mother, themselves, their sisters? What about all those boys? What about all the young men and boys who have been traumatized by adult men's violence? You know what? The same system that produces men who abuse women produces men who abuse other men. And if we want to talk about male victims, let's talk about male victims. Most male victims of violence are the victims of other men's violence. So that's something that both women and men have in common. We are both victims of men's violence. So we have it in our direct self-interest, not to mention the fact that most men that I know have women and girls that we care deeply about in our families, in our friendship circles, and every other way. So there's so many reasons why we need men to speak out. It seems obvious saying it out loud, doesn't it? Now, the nature of the work that I do and my colleagues do in the sports culture, in the U.S. military, in schools, we pioneered this approach called the bystander approach to gender violence prevention. And I just want to give you the highlights of the bystander approach because it's a big sort of thematic shift, although there's lots of particulars. But the heart of it is, instead of seeing men as perpetrators, women as victims, or women as perpetrators, men as victims, or any combination in there, I'm using the gender binary. I know there's more than men and women. There's more than male and female. And there are women who are perpetrators, and there are men who are victims. There's a whole spectrum. But instead of seeing it in the binary fashion, we focus on all of us as what we call bystanders. And a bystander is defined as anybody who is not a perpetrator or a victim in a given situation. So in other words, friends, teammates, colleagues, coworkers, family members, those of us who are not directly involved in a dyad of abuse, but we are embedded in social, family, work, school, and other peer culture relationships with people who might be in that situation. What do? How do we speak up? How do we challenge our friends? How do we support our friends? But how do we not remain silent in the face of abuse? Now, when it comes to men and male culture, the goal is to get men who are not abusive to challenge men who are. And when I say abusive, I don't mean just men who are beating women. We're not just saying that whose friend is abusing his girlfriend needs to stop the guy at the moment of attack. I mean, that's a naive way of creating a social change. It's along a continuum we're trying to get men to interrupt each other. So, for example, if you're a guy and you're in a group of guys playing poker, talking, hanging out, no women present, and another guy says something sexist or degrading or harassing about women, instead of laughing along or pretending you didn't hear it, we need men to say, hey, that's not funny. You know, it could be my, sister you're talking about, and could you joke about something else? Or could you talk about something else? I don't appreciate that kind of talk. Just like if you're a white person and another white person makes a racist comment, I hope, that white people would interrupt that racist enactment by a fellow white person. Just like with heterosexism, if you're a heterosexual person and you yourself don't enact harassing or abusive behaviors towards people of varying sexual orientations, if you don't say something in the face of other heterosexual people doing that, then in a sense, isn't your silence a form of consent and complicity? Well, the bystander approach is trying to give people tools to interrupt that process and to speak up and to create a peer culture climate where the abusive behavior will be seen as unacceptable, not just because it's illegal, but because it's wrong and unacceptable in the peer culture. And if we can get to the place where men who act out in sexist ways will lose status, young men and boys who act out in sexist and harassing ways towards girls and women, as well as towards other boys and men, will lose status as a result of it, guess what? We'll see a radical diminution of the abuse, because the typical perpetrator is not sick and twisted. He's a normal guy in every other way, isn't he? Now, among the many great things that Martin Luther King said in his short life was, in the end, what'll hurt the most is not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. In the end, what will hurt the most is not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. There's been an awful lot of silence in male culture about this ongoing tragedy of men's violence against women and children, hasn't there? There's been an awful lot of silence. And all I'm saying is that we need to break that silence, and we need more men to do that. Now, it's easier said than done, because I'm saying it now, but I'm telling you, it's not easy in male culture for guys to challenge each other, which is one of the reasons why part of the paradigm shift that has to happen is not just understanding these issues as men's issues, but they're also leadership issues for men, because ultimately the responsibility for taking a stand on these issues should not fall on the shoulder of little boys or teenage boys in high school or college men. It should be on adult men with power. Adult men with power are the ones we need to be holding accountable for being leaders on these issues. Because when somebody speaks up in a peer culture and challenges and interrupts, he or she is being a leader, really, right? But on a big scale, we need more adult men with power to start prioritizing these issues. And we haven't seen that yet, have we? Now, I was at a dinner a number of years ago, and I work extensively with the U.S. military, all the services. And I was at this dinner, and this woman said to me, I think she thought she was a little clever, she said, "So how long have you been doing sensitivity training with the Marines?" And I said, with all due respect, I don't do sensitivity training with the Marines. I run a leadership program in the Marine Corps. Now, I know it's a bit pompous, my response, but it's an important distinction, because I don't believe that what we need is sensitivity training. We need leadership training. Because, for example, when a professional coach or manager of a baseball team or a football team, and I work extensively in that realm as well, makes a sexist comment, makes a homophobic statement, makes a racist comment, there'll be discussions on the sports blogs and in sports talk radio, and some people say, well, he needs sensitivity training, and other people will say, well, get off it, you know, that's political correctness run amok, and he made a stupid statement, move on. My argument is he doesn't need sensitivity training. He needs leadership training, because he's being a bad leader. Because in a society with gender diversity and sexual diversity and racial and ethnic diversity, you make those kind of comments, you're failing at your leadership. If we can make this point that I'm making to powerful men and women in our society at all levels of institutional authority and power, it's going to change. It's going to change the paradigm of people's thinking. You know, for example, I work a lot in college and university athletics throughout North America, right? We know so much about how to prevent domestic and sexual violence, right? There's no excuse for a college or university to not have domestic and sexual violence prevention training mandated for all student athletes, coaches, and administrators as part of their educational process. We know enough to know that we can easily do that, but you know what's missing? The leadership. But it's not the leadership of student athletes. It's the leadership of the athletic director, the president of the university, the people in charge who make decisions about resources and who make decisions about priorities in the institutional settings, right? That's a failure in most cases of men's leadership. Look at Penn State. Penn State is the mother of all teachable moments for the bystander approach. You had so many situations in that realm where men in powerful positions failed to act to protect children, in this case, boys. It's unbelievable, really. But when you get into it, you realize there are pressures on men. There are constraints within peer cultures on men, which is why we need to encourage men to break through those pressures. And one of the ways to do that is to say there's an awful lot of men who care deeply about these issues. I know this. I work with men, and I've been working with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of men for many, many decades now. It's scary when you think about it, how many years. But there's so many men who care deeply about these issues, but caring deeply is not enough. We need more men with the guts, with the courage, with the strength, with the moral integrity to break our complicit silence and challenge each other and stand with women, not against them. By the way, we owe it to women. There's no question about it, but we also owe it to our sons. We also owe it to young men who are growing up all over the world in situations where they didn't make the choice to be a man in a culture that tells them that manhood is a certain way. They didn't make the choice. We that have a choice have an opportunity and a responsibility to them as well. I hope that going forward, men and women working together can begin the change and the transformation that'll happen so that future generations won't have the level of tragedy that we deal with on a daily basis. I know we can do it. We can do better. Thank you very much.
Good. Good evening, men. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings. If you have just joined us, we have approximately 45 minutes left to the hour of midnight, and then we chime in and we say goodbye. So tonight we're talking about the head of the household. Now, we had various clips and various TED Talks here to illustrate, you know, toxic masculinity, also how to be gentle, and also why, the question of why. Why are men raping women? Why are people doing whatever they are doing? What institutions are to blame for people's behaviors? What happened? So I was talking about the concept of head of the household. Now, head of the household is a widely used term, wildly and widely used term, right? To say that the head of the house is traditionally, it's something that traditionally means taking ultimate responsibility for the family's well-being, including providing food, shelter, and financial support. Now, we went into the conversation around what it is to ensure the well-being of the family. And my understanding of it is that if our gentlemen, right, are struggling so much with finding their balance and finding their feet, then how will the women that are next to them allow them to lead them? Because I know that I'm not going to be led by somebody that cannot lead themselves. I'm not going to be dictated by somebody that cannot discipline themselves. I'm not going to listen to somebody. I'm not going to listen to somebody that has gone bankrupt about my finances. Like, I know. I'm not going to listen to somebody that has had a failed marriage for my marriage. I'm not going to listen to somebody that has no people skills whatsoever tell me about individuals. And it's just the same as I use this analogy a lot, where I say that I am not going to listen to you that has never ever been an employer or a boss or anything of your own coming to tell me how to run mine. I would never. And especially for those that have actually failed at doing it, I wouldn't listen to you like that, because then you haven't walked a mile in my shoes. I would listen to people that have had, you know, and they've lost, you know. I would listen to the loss, but I will not listen to your advice, because that's how you got onto the losing side, most, because maybe things didn't go well. And not unless you can prove otherwise. That's where my mind is at. And that is why I think that right now, the pandemic that we are facing is the fact that we have many men that are incapable of leading themselves, but also incapable of understanding that they have to be led. They have to be shown, and they say things like, yes, the man is the head and the woman is the neck, you know, that the head can't turn without the neck. But who wants to be a neck? Neck don't have eyes, they don't have ears, they don't see. That's not the first thing that you see. How many times did you go out there into the world and the first thing you notice about somebody is their neck? So does it mean, to be a woman, does it mean that you must sit in the shadows of a man, even if this man is the same guy that's driving through water, that everybody is turning around, even including other men, because we're supposed to smell that men are great leaders, right? Even other men are turning away from this water with bigger cars and bigger engines than yours, and you go into the water, and that's the guy that we must listen to. That's the guy that is going to dictate what our children study, where they are going to study, when they are going, and that's the decision maker, that guy. The guy that gets swept away by the water, that guy. Ah, guys. The same person that doesn't actually know how to start anything and finish anything. That's the person. we are supposed to be trusting with our lives, because I don't know, man. It kind of seems absurd. But apparently we're told that we must love no matter what.
Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no compassion, it deserves no treatment as minority martyrdom, and it deserves not to be deemed anything but a pernicious sickness. That's from Time magazine in 1966, when I was 3 years old. And last year, the President of the United States came out in favor of gay marriage. And my question is, how did we get from there to here? How did an illness become an identity? When I was perhaps 6 years old, I went to a shoe store with my mother and my brother, and at the end of buying our shoes, the salesman said to us that we could each have a balloon to take home. My brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. My mother said that she thought I'd really rather have a blue balloon, but I said that I definitely wanted the pink one, and she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence of both my mother's influence and its limits. When I was little, my mother used to say, "The love you have for your children is like no other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it's like." And when I was little, I took it as the greatest compliment in the world that she would say that about parenting my brother and me. And when I was an adolescent, I thought, "But I'm gay, and so I probably can't have a family." And when she said it, it made me anxious. And after I came out of the closet, when she continued to say it, it made me furious. I said, "I'm gay. That's not the direction that I'm headed in, and I want you to stop saying that." About 20 years ago, I was asked by my editors at the New York Times Magazine to write a piece about deaf culture, and I was rather taken aback. I had thought of deafness entirely as an illness. Those poor people, they couldn't hear, they lacked hearing, and what could we do for them? And then I went out into the deaf world. I went to deaf clubs. I saw performances of deaf theater and of deaf poetry. I even went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, Tennessee, where people complained about that slurry Southern signing. And as I plunged deeper and deeper into the deaf world, I became convinced that deafness was a culture, and that the people in the deaf world who said, "We don't lack hearing, we have membership in a culture," were saying something that was viable. It wasn't my culture, and I didn't particularly want to rush off and join it, but I appreciated that it was a culture, and that for the people who were members of it, it felt as valuable as Latino culture, or gay culture, or Jewish culture. It felt as valid, perhaps even, as American culture. Then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And when her daughter was born, she suddenly found herself confronting questions that now began to seem quite resonant to me. She was facing the question of what to do with this child. Should she say, "You're just like everyone else, but a little bit shorter"? Or should she try to construct some kind of dwarf identity, get involved in the little people of America, become aware of what was happening for dwarfs? And I suddenly thought, most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Those hearing parents tend to try to cure them. Those deaf people discover community somehow in adolescence. Most gay people are born to straight parents. Those straight parents often want them to function in what they think of as the mainstream world, and those gay people have to discover identity later on. And here was this friend of mine looking at these questions of identity with her dwarf daughter, and I thought, there it is again, a family that perceives itself to be normal with a child who seems to be extraordinary. And I hatched the idea that there are really two kinds of identity. There are vertical identities, which are passed down generationally from parent to child. Those are things like ethnicity, frequently nationality, language, often religion. Those are things you have in common with your parents and with your children. And while some of them can be difficult, there's no attempt to cure them. You could argue that it's harder in the United States, our current presidency notwithstanding, to be a person of color. And yet, we have nobody who is trying to ensure that the next generation of children born to African Americans and Asians come out with creamy skin and yellow hair. There are these other identities which you have to learn from a peer group. And I call them horizontal identities because the peer group is the horizontal experience. These are identities that are alien to your parents and that you have to discover when you get to see them in peers. And those identities, those horizontal identities, people have almost always tried to cure. And I wanted to look at what the process is through which people who have those identities come to a good relationship with them. And it seemed to me that there were three levels of acceptance that needed to take place. There's self-acceptance, there's family acceptance, and there's social acceptance. And they don't always coincide. And a lot of the time, people who have these conditions are very angry because they feel as though their parents don't love them, when what actually has happened is that their parents don't accept them. Love is something that ideally is there unconditionally throughout the relationship between a parent and a child. But acceptance is something that takes time. It always takes time. One of the dwarfs I got to know was a guy named Clinton Brown. When he was born, he was diagnosed with diastrophic dwarfism, a very disabling condition, and his parents were told that he would never walk, he would never talk, he would have no intellectual capacity, and he would probably not even recognize them. And it was suggested to them that they leave him at the hospital so that he could die there quietly. And his mother said she wasn't going to do it, and she took her son home, and even though she didn't have a lot of educational or financial advantages, she found the best doctor in the country for dealing with diastrophic dwarfism, and she got Clinton enrolled with him, and in the course of his childhood, he had 30 major surgical procedures. And he spent all this time stuck in the hospital while he was having those procedures, as a result of which he now can walk. And while he was there, they sent tutors around to help him with his schoolwork, and he worked very hard because there was nothing else to do. And he ended up achieving at a level that had never before been contemplated by any member of his family. He was the first one in his family, in fact, to go to college, where he lived on campus and drove a specially fitted car that accommodated his unusual body. And his mother told me the story of coming home one day, and he went to college nearby, and she said, and I saw that car, which you can always recognize, in the parking lot of a bar, she said. And I thought to myself, they're 6 feet tall, he's 3 feet tall, 2 beers for them is 4 beers for him. She said, I knew I couldn't go in there and interrupt him, but I went home and I left him 8 messages on his cell phone. She said, and then I thought, if someone had said to me when he was born that my future worry would be that he'd go drinking and driving with his college buddies. And I said to her, what do you think you did that helped him to emerge as this charming, accomplished, wonderful person? And she said, what did I do? I loved him, that's all. Clinton just always had that light in him, and his father and I were lucky enough to be the first to see it there. I'm going to quote from another magazine of the 60s. This one is from 1968, The Atlantic Monthly, Voice of Liberal America, written by an important bioethicist. He said, there is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome child away, whether it is put away in the sense of hidden in a sanitarium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person. There's been a lot of ink given to the enormous progress that we've made in the treatment of gay people. The fact that our attitude has changed is in the headlines every day. But we forget how we used to see people who had other differences, how we used to see people who were disabled, how inhuman we held people to be. And the change that's been accomplished there, which is almost equally radical, is one that we pay not very much attention to. One of the families I interviewed, Tom and Karen Robards, were taken aback when, as young and successful New Yorkers, their first child was diagnosed with Down syndrome. They thought the educational opportunities for him were not what they should be, and so they decided they would build a little center, two classrooms that they started with a few other parents to educate kids with DS. And over the years, that center grew into something called the Cook Center, where there are now thousands upon thousands of children with intellectual disabilities who are being taught. In the time since that Atlantic Monthly story ran, the life expectancy for people with Down syndrome has tripled. The experience of Down syndrome people includes those who are actors, those who are writers, some who are able to live fully independently in adulthood. The Robards had a lot to do with that, and I said, do you regret it? Do you wish your child didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish you'd never heard of it? And interestingly, his father said, well, for David, our son, I regret it, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I'd like to give David an easier life. But I think if we lost everyone with Down syndrome, it would be a catastrophic loss. And Karen Robards said to me, I'm with Tom. For David, I would cure it in an instant to give him an easier life. But speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 23 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point. Speaking for myself, it's made me so much better and so much kinder and so much more purposeful in my whole life that speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world. We live at a point when social acceptance for these and many other conditions is on the up and up. And yet we also live at the moment when our ability to eliminate those conditions has reached a height we never imagined before. Most deaf infants born in the United States now will receive cochlear implants, which are put into the brain and connected to a receiver and which allow them to acquire a facsimile of hearing and to use oral speech. A compound that has been tested in mice, BMN-111, is useful in preventing the action of the achondroplasia gene. Achondroplasia is the most common form of dwarfism, and mice who have been given that substance and who have the achondroplasia gene grow to full size. Testing in humans is around the corner. There are blood tests which are making progress that would pick up Down syndrome more clearly and earlier in pregnancies than ever before, making it easier and easier for people to eliminate those pregnancies or to terminate them. And so we have both social progress and medical progress. And I believe in both of them. I believe the social progress is fantastic and meaningful and wonderful. And I think the same thing about the medical progress. But I think it's a tragedy when one of them doesn't see the others. And when I see the way they're intersecting in conditions like the three I've just described, I sometimes think it's like those moments in grand opera when the hero realizes he loves the heroine at the exact moment that she lies expiring on a divan. We have to think about how we feel about cures altogether. And a lot of the time, the question of parenthood is, what do we validate in our children and what do we cure in them? Jim Sinclair, a prominent autism activist, said, when parents say, I wish my child did not have autism, what they're really saying is, I wish the child I have did not exist, and I had a different non-autistic child instead. Read that again. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we hear when you pray for a cure, that your fondest wish for us is that someday we will cease to be, and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces. It's a very extreme point of view, but it points to the reality that people engage with the life they have, and they don't want to be cured or changed or eliminated. They want to be whoever it is that they've come to be. One of the families I interviewed for this project was the family of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre. It took a long time to persuade them to talk to me, and once they agreed, they were so full of their story that they couldn't stop telling it. And the first weekend I spent with them, the first of many, I recorded more than 20 hours of conversation. And on Sunday night, we were all exhausted. We were sitting in the kitchen. Sue Klebold was fixing dinner. And I said, if Dylan were here now, do you have a sense of what you'd want to ask him? And his father said, I sure do. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And Sue looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute. And then she looked back up and said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. When I had dinner with her a couple of years later, one of many dinners that we had together, she said, you know, when it first happened, I used to wish that I had never married, that I had never had children. If I hadn't gone to Ohio State and crossed paths with Tom, this child wouldn't have existed and this terrible thing wouldn't have happened. But I've come to feel that I love the children I had so much that I don't want to imagine a life without them. I recognize the pain they cause to others, for which there can be no forgiveness, but the pain they cause to me, there is, she said. So while I recognize that it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided that it would not have been better for me. I thought it was surprising how all of these families had all of these children with all of these problems, problems that they mostly would have done anything to avoid, and that they had all found so much meaning in that experience of parenting. And then I thought, all of us who have children love the children we have with their flaws. If some glorious angel suddenly descended through my living room ceiling and offered to take away the children I have and give me other, better children, more polite, funnier, nicer, smarter, I would cling to the children I have and pray away that atrocious spectacle. And ultimately, I feel that in the same way that we test flame-retardant pajamas in an inferno to ensure they won't catch fire when our child reaches across the stove, so these stories of families negotiating these extreme differences reflect on the universal experience of parenting, which is always that sometimes you look at your child and you think, where did you come from? It turns out that while each of these individual differences is siloed, there are only so many families dealing with schizophrenia. There are only so many families of children who are transgender. There are only so many families of prodigies who also face similar challenges in many ways. There are only so many families in each of those categories. But if you start to think that the experience of negotiating difference within your family is what people are addressing, then you discover that it's a nearly universal phenomenon. Ironically, it turns out that it's our differences and our negotiation of difference that unite us. I decided to have children while I was working on this project. And many people were astonished and said, but how can you decide to have children in the midst of studying everything that can go wrong? And I said, I'm not studying everything that can go wrong. What I'm studying is how much love there can be, even when everything appears to be going wrong. I thought a lot about the mother of one disabled child I had seen, severely disabled child who died through caregiver neglect, and when his ashes were interred, his mother said, I pray here for forgiveness for having been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted, and once of the son I loved. And I figured it was possible then for anyone to love any child if they had the effective will to do so. So my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. I had a close friend from college who'd gone through a divorce and wanted to have children, and so she and I have a daughter, and mother and daughter live in Texas. And my husband and I have a son who lives with us all the time, of whom I am the biological father, and our surrogate for the pregnancy was Laura, the lesbian mother of Oliver and Lucy in Minneapolis. So, the shorthand is, five parents of four children in three states. And there are people who think that the existence of my family somehow undermines or weakens or damages their family. And there are people who think that families like mine shouldn't be allowed to exist. And I don't accept subtractive models of love, only additive ones. And I believe that in the same way that we need species diversity to ensure that the planet can go on, so we need this diversity of affection and diversity of family in order to strengthen the ecosphere of kindness. The day after our son was born, the pediatrician came into the hospital room and said she was concerned. He wasn't extending his legs appropriately. She said that might mean that he had brain damage. Insofar as he was extending them, he was doing so asymmetrically, which he thought could mean that there was a tumor of some kind in action. And he had a very large head, which he thought might indicate hydrocephalus. And as she told me all of these things, I felt the very center of my being pouring out onto the floor. And I thought, here I had been working for years on a book about how much meaning people had found in the experience of parenting children who were disabled, and I didn't want to join their number. Because what I was encountering was an idea of illness, and like all parents since the dawn of time, I wanted to protect my child from illness. And I wanted also to protect myself from illness. And yet I knew from the work I had done that if he had any of the things we were about to start testing for, that those would ultimately be his identity. And if they were his identity, they would become my identity. That that illness was going to take a very different shape as it unfolded. We took him to the MRI machine. We took him to the CAT scanner. We took this day-old child and gave him over for an arterial blood draw. We felt helpless. And at the end of 5 hours, they said that his brain was completely clear and that he was by then extending his legs correctly. And when I asked the pediatrician what had been going on, she said she thought in the morning he had probably had a cramp. But I thought how my mother was right. I thought the love you have for your children is unlike any other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it feels like. I think children had ensnared me the moment I connected fatherhood with loss. But I'm not sure I would have noticed that if I hadn't been so in the thick of this research project of mine. I had encountered so much strange love, and I fell very naturally into its bewitching patterns. And I saw how splendor can illuminate even the most abject vulnerabilities. During these 10 years, I had witnessed and learned the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility, and I had come to see how it conquers everything else. And while I had sometimes thought the parents I was interviewing were fools, enslaving themselves to a lifetime's journey with their thankless children and trying to breed identity out of misery, I realized that day that my research had built me a plank and that I was ready to join them on their ship. Thank you.
Round of applause of a lifetime. And you might be thinking, why did she play that one? It was about children with challenges and people with challenges. It is because I believe that these are part of the challenges that every single human being faces, including men. Men February. And those are part of the conversations that I would like to have this February. I would like to have conversations of this nature. I would like to hear men talk about their stories. I would like to hear about it. But the first one that we are starting with is the one of head of the household. In African history, particularly within Bantu-speaking communities, the head of the house refers to the patriarch overseeing a specific household until within a large household unit. Until unit within a large segmented homestead. Historically based on a patriarchy, this position managed distinct houses, formed by a different wives, often classifying them into a great house. Primary, senior, the right hand of the house is secondary and the left is primary. You know, structure, homestead, you know, leadership, success, roles and functions, colonial impacts, you know, these are the conversations that we're supposed to be having when it comes to ancient times and the concept of head of the household. Head of the household is most now supposed to be the dude that is looking after the household, that is basically overseeing the household, making sure that the house is managed properly. And it is not a sin to actually give over some roles that you cannot perform. It is not, because that is what a helper is. A helper is somebody that is going to assist you in your job to make it better, to make it more flexible, to make it more enthusiastic, to make it more loving and likely, right? So that we can do our absolute, absolute best when it comes to running a family, right? And that is why we're talking about it. We're talking about head of the household. And we're talking about everything that is to do with the head of the household. Now, part of the head of the household responsibilities to manage finances. So let's see.
If your private student loans are in default, you're not out of options. Go to yrefi.com/Ramsey.
My wife and I are a single income family. We have two babies, a 4-year-old, 2-year-old, and one due next month. And we recently started following the baby steps. And my question is regarding the size of our debt and when exactly should we start tackling this? So we have about $600,000 in student loans plus a mortgage and two car leases, which after listening to Dave Ramsey, we're going to get rid of.
How much is the student loans?
So $500,000 me, $100,000 for my wife.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then tell me about the cars.
So the cars are two leases, just an F-150 and an Expedition.
What are the prices every month?
We pay about $800 for her car, about $600 for mine.
My. Okay. This is an expensive situation.
Yeah, I know. We made these before listening to the brand. Mm-hmm.
What's your degree in for $500K?
I'm a plastic surgeon.
Good.
Oh, what's your income? Did we ask that?
It varies a little bit, but it's about $750.
Excellent. Great excellent. News. Excellent. Well, okay.
That's the good news. Yeah.
Okay. So this kind of puts it in perspective. It's all relative, right? Depending on the numbers. So When's the baby due?
Baby due is in 3 to 4 weeks from now.
Okay. And what money do you have saved?
We have about $122,000 in a high yield saving.
Okay, so you've got, would you say that covers 6 months of expenses or 4 months? How many months of expenses does that cover?
That should cover about over 6 months.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, typically we say when there's a baby coming, you're kind of in stork mode, save up as much as you can. You've got plenty saved.
Yeah, but hold on. Let's just get real here. What's your take home? As a plastic surgeon, what's your average take home in a month?
So in a month, I've been averaging about 34.
Right, you got plenty of money.
You've got gobs of money. You can fix this so fast, it's not even funny. Jay's going to walk you through it, but I don't think he needs to stack up.
No, I said he doesn't. I'm just also saying for the benefit of a listener who is used to us saying, if there's a baby coming, stop and save.
Right.
I'm explaining why he doesn't need to do that because he's got plenty saved. So you don't need to do that. We normally would give that advice, but you've got plenty. And so I would go ahead and push play. Even if there were some form of complications and your insurance kicked in and you hit your full deductible, even if you hit your out-of-pocket max for the year, you'd be fine. So that's why I think that you can go ahead and hit play on this. And if I were you, when are these leases up?
so next year.
Oh, can you find out what it is to get out of them early?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our plan. Our plan is to find out and get rid of them as fast as we can.
Yeah, do that. Do that. There's no need in keeping this around any faster. I would take a little bit of the money of the $122,000 you have saved and buy mm-hmm. some cash cars. And it's not going to be the be all end all. I'm not saying you have to spend $4,000, but I am saying it's probably going to be less than the cars you drive now just to get you something in cash. But don't drop that emergency fund below 6 months in order to do this. And then I would start getting cracking with the rest of that money. Once the baby is born, with the rest of that 6 month fund, I would come in and I would clear out one of these student loans, and you're going to drop that pretty low.
Mm-hmm. I guess my wife and I worry is that given the size of our student loans, if we follow the baby steps, we will kind of burn through all our savings.
Yeah.
And be a little ways away from being able to pay them and being a single income family.
Okay. So let me address that, because I'm going to tell you straight up. I'll tell you the 100% truth. Mm-hmm. If you do it the way that I'm going to suggest, it's going to feel uncomfortable. Because I want you to be debt-free really, really fast, because I value the same thing you do, which is to get to security quickly, right? Mm-hmm. To your point, you're a one-income family. You've got lots of kids. Right now, your house is on fire. You've got almost $700,000 of debt. So you got to clear it out. So I'm on your side in the way that I want to do it as quickly as possible. So if you take $122,000 and you pay off the $100,000 student loan, you clear out the mortgages, you spend $10,000 or $11,000 each on some knock-around cars until this thing is cleared out. And then for, I don't know, a year, you guys live on $200,000 instead of $700,000, and you pay off the $500,000 student loan. I think that that's possible. Because most people in the United States wish they had a $200,000 income. So if you live on $250 and use the other $500 to pay off the loans, you're done in a year.
Mm-hmm. So pretty much live with a minimum or minimal emergency savings until those are done.
Are you familiar with our baby steps?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, so that means you have $1,000.
Same baby step number two.
Yeah, but if you were to follow the baby steps the way we teach, you are emptying that savings account.
Because here's the thing.
Right.
Let me hit you with this. Let's play it out. Let's say I tell you, hey, drop your savings down to $1,000 just to have a little cash there. Pay off the $100,000 student loan. Like I said, pay $10,000 or $11,000 each on some cars. And over the course of the year, spend $500,000 of your income to pay off this debt.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an emergency, what's the worst emergency you can think of? The roof blowing off your house?
Right. I mean, something happening to me that I wouldn't be able to work.
So that's a life insurance question. So we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
But let's pretend a big gust of wind comes tomorrow. You've taken your savings down to $1,000 and the roof blows off your house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something crazy. You make $34,000 a month. I'm pretty sure you could stop paying debt for that month and cash flow whatever the emergency is, right?
That's a very good point. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Now, if you're concerned about your being a one income family, that's a life insurance question.
And disability.
And disability. Do you have life insurance?
I have both, yeah.
Okay, then you're covered.
So the point is, if something happens to you and you can no longer be a plastic surgeon, have you put in place policies that would take care of you and your family?
I have, yeah.
All right, then. So what are we stressing out about? Now, we know this is extreme, but let's play the numbers out so you can catch a little vision here, because Jay just played out how you can knock off, you know, a lot of debt. So if you fix these car leases and can get out of these, and then you knock out your wife's student loan, now you've got a $500,000 chunk. How much money, if you're on a tight budget, could you put towards debt that student loan every month based on the 34?
Yeah, I think projecting with the three babies, we could probably put away at least maybe 15 or a little more per month.
Right. So let's keep it at 15 for round numbers, right? So you just do the math. 15,000 a month over the course of how many months knocks out the $500,000. I think it's really important that you have that in your head so that you go, okay, I've got to do this. It's not for 10 years. It's for, you know, whatever that's going to end up being. I don't, I'm not that good at math. All right. 15 times 10 months, obviously is 150,000. Yeah. So we're looking at 3+ years at the 15,000. But that's just at that. But that's to say you gave us an average month. So, you know, how does a plastic surgeon go make more money? That would be the answer I'd be wanting to know. I don't know. I don't know. That's not my world, but I bet there's a way. How do you, what do you have to do to make $1 million?
Yeah. Cause taxes is eating up a lot of this.
I know there's a lot of vain people.
My point is, and I was using very round numbers, two round probably, but my point is, the quicker you get this done, the quicker you can go back to living your plastic surgeon's lifestyle with the cars you want and the income you want and the savings that you want. But if you're trying to solve for security, security is best gotten quickly, not little by little, drip by drip over time. You want to get to that place of security fast, and ripping off the Band-Aid is the way to get that.
Why Refi refinances defaulted private student loans for struggling borrowers. Learn more at YREFY.com/Ramsey.
All righty. So that's for those that are in debt, and that's for those that are not doing well financially and they just need that emotional pick-me-up, especially when it comes to the head of the household. So that is what the head of the household does, ne? The head of the household tries to keep you guys out of debt. The head of the household doesn't put you in debt, tries to keep you out of debt, tries to make sure that you guys are working towards becoming debt-free. That is part of the examples of what the head of the house is supposed to do. Now, the head of the house, right? I think that this is a title that should be given, not just because of our genitalia, but because of the work that we are doing towards the family and the structure. And it doesn't only depend on three categories, which is shelter, food, and financial support. There are also other elements to it that also need just as much attention as all these other areas. Part of the attention that is needed there is also, for example, part of the things that we do need is emotional support. We do need emotional support. We do need mental support. We do understand that at the end of the day, we are not, especially when we are in families, right? We are not independent in a way of saying that we must depend on ourselves only. But the matriarch or the patriarch of the family must ensure that the clan is doing well in all areas. That is why, ladies and gentlemen, in case you haven't noticed, especially with African families, right? There is this thing of we hate it, but we understand why it happens, called black text. So this black text usually comes from the head of the household. And he doesn't have to say that this is what he's doing. He can just plant a seed in the neck. And that is why older siblings end up paying for the younger siblings' school. They end up maintaining the younger siblings' because they were also maintained, and they also look out for their cousins. They also look out for family. They also look out, you know, for others, and just the same as they were looked out for. So I believe that the head of the household is not a title that is only given to a man. The head of the household is for the person that is getting things moving, is getting things done, is pushing, is going through. That is what the head of the house is supposed to be doing. I believe that the head of the house is somebody that is legendary, somebody that will not be forgotten. And that is why in Oshindonga they say, Hunguru, Nenge Hunguru, Hunguru Wazimo. You know, I believe that that is the head of the household, the one that draws everybody together eventually, even if it is just through peace and through conversation and through being there for most things. And that is why in many of our African cultures, right, we attend each other's festivities and grievances. We do attend because that is what family does. And it is something that was, these are principles and norms that were set there by heads, not necks, but by heads. And these heads deserve recognition regardless of their gender. So from me, the matriarch, tonight, I bid you guys farewell. I'll see you again tomorrow. Au revoir. Ciao, ciao. Nashi check.